Hey there, you. This is the New World Order bonus Christmas episode. I'm doing this episode because Christmas time is at hand, and I know that Christmas, for some people, can be a weird holiday, or it's not a holiday at all, and so it's just a weird time of year. And I figured it might be fun to sit down and kind of have a little fireside chat, as it were, while everyone else goes about their own business, doing whatever they may or may not be doing this week or this day. And of course that's really the crux of it, right? Is that there's so much noise out there about what you're supposed to do on Christmas or around Christmas, that if you're the person not doing that, it does feel strange. Or maybe you have nostalgia, good or bad, about what's supposed to happen this time of year, and maybe that's affecting the way you see everything. So I'm personally not actually alone this year, but I've been alone before around Christmas time. It doesn't generally affect me, but I know it does some other people. And so this episode is for you, whether you're alone this holiday or whether you're just having a nice relaxing afternoon with nothing better to do. Whatever the reason, it's a bonus episode. It does not count toward the total 52 episodes this year. Okay, so I've got two topics, and one is a reference, sort of, to what I used to do when I was alone over the holidays, and that is to play solo games. Solo games on the tabletop, specifically. So, not computer games, actually. But in recent years, I've rediscovered, as I've talked about in a Hacker Public Radio episode, months ago, maybe even years ago now, game books, which are... They were sold back in the 80s, probably, maybe 90s, or maybe both, I don't know. They were sold in bookstores, and they were very frequently just, they were sort of, you've seen them, choose your own adventure books, essentially. Now, choose your own adventure books are fun on their own, but it doesn't take you that long to sort of grow out of them, because they are a little bit simple, like straight choose your own adventure, like the brand choose your own adventure. They were pretty simple. You know, you can really kind of detect the linear flow of each little story, and you knew that there were basically, you get this little 150-page book, you know that there are about four adventures in there, adventure paths in there, and so you can kind of anticipate, okay, there are going to be, these many choices to make, and the choices are generally pretty obvious as to which one's a good idea, which one's a bad idea, and that sort of thing. And they're all usually quite morally centered, sort of like the good answers get you to a good place, the obviously rude answers get you to a bad place, and so on. So that's my memory of the straight choose your own adventure books. But if you graduate beyond those, you get into other game books, such as certainly one of my, I think probably my favorite series, and it's probably not coincidental that it is free online, but it's called the White Wolf series, which, I mean, not the White Wolf series, sorry, the Lone Wolf series, and it is published at projectaon.org. That's project and then aon.org. They're really good. Flight from the Dark is the first book. It's just a lot of fun. It's essentially a choose-your-own-adventure, but it has things for you to track, such as weapons that you can gather. It has dice rolls that you can make in order to succeed in combat or to see what happens sometimes, whether you choose the correct direction or not. So it's a really good series, and it is digital, and that's kind of what I'm getting towards here, is that recently my solo gaming has kind of transferred from physical card games and things like that to online ebooks, either EPUBs in the case of the Lone Wolf series, or PDFs in some of the older sort of archived by random people instance. And they are sometimes difficult to find. You have to look around for the PDFs, unfortunately. But they're out there, and they are very often either centered around Tunnels and Trolls or Dungeons and Dragons, and they have kind of the same setup, sort of some of the same conventions where it's essentially a choose-your-own-adventure, but there's that added element of inventory management and dice rolling and so on. There was one that I played, actually, recently. This is also my, this is generally, in addition to it being a good holiday filler when you don't have anything else to do, but you feel like you should be relaxing, it's also a good thing to do when you're alone in a hotel, like if you're on a business trip or something, which I don't do very, very frequently, but I do like once or twice a year maybe. So these are great for those evenings where you're just kind of like sitting around, not very familiar with the city, not really sure what's going on around you. So you just sit down and play a solo game. I to this day I associate the tinkling of the of dice being dropped into a glass with playing solo games in a hotel. And that is because you know how in a hotel they have those they have the water glasses, you know. So I always used those as my dice tray, and I drop my dice into there because it's just better than you know losing the die when it rolls off the table. So anyway, solo games, a lot of fun. Not really a whole lot of point in talking about them on a show about GNU/Linux, which this is. And so, by way of tying this in, I would like to talk about this little application called Twine, Twine. And it is available, if you want to take a quick gander at it, at twinery.org, twinery.org. The cool thing about Twine is that it's a framework, I guess, or you could, I guess you can call it an application because there's a runnable there is a runnable file, you know, there's an executable file for this thing, and it helps you make games structured like a choose your own adventure story. Now, it's pretty flexible, so it doesn't have to be sort of a literal, it doesn't have to be a choose your own adventure story. It can be lots of different things, but I think so far that is largely the form that I've seen it take. There are a couple of really good examples, but and I'll get to those, but first let's look at where to get this thing. So twinery.org, as I've said, over on the right-hand side of the page, there are downloads for all the different systems. And somewhat confusingly, it says Linux and then in parentheses 32-bit. And I took that to mean, okay, so if I click the Linux thing, it's going to give me a 32-bit application. And actually, what it meant was if you click Linux, it'll give you 64-bit. If you click the word 32-bit, then it gives you the 32-bit. So they're two separate links. That may not matter to you. It actually didn't matter to me. I clicked on the Linux thing thinking I was going to get 32-bit, knowing that that wouldn't matter because I have it also. I have a multi-lib system, my Slackware installed. I installed 32-bit libraries as well. So it doesn't matter, but that's just something that I'm pointing out for you. So if you download that, it gives you a zip file which you can unarchive, and there's an executable in that directory called Twine. And if you click on that, it should open up a window, you know, the application window. If it doesn't, try dropping out down to a terminal and do a ./twine. For some reason on Fedora, it worked just by clicking on Slackware. It didn't know. It kept asking me what it should open in, which is weird because it is. It's an if you do like file twine, it says it's an ELF binary. So I'm not really sure why it was confused. But there you go. So that's how you get the application to start with. Now I'm gonna refer you to a couple of different links because I think it's worth seeing some of these things in practice. Now there was a very famous example of it recently. And I don't remember the famous person's name who used it. It was on CBS or something like that. And I just don't remember who it was. The name John Oliver keeps popping into my head, but I don't know that that's the correct one. I'm not even clear. I'm not 100% sure who John Oliver is. But there is a, you know, it got a little bit of bonus attention recently because it got used in some kind of almost an old school internet gag, you know. There wasn't a real point to it. It was just something silly. But I think that highlights just how easy Twine is to use. I mean, people are picking it up, I guess, and making games with really zero coding experience. And that's kind of the brilliance here. Twine at its core, like if you really think about it, first of all, the things to picture are classic computer games like Colossal Cave or Zork, as you may know it, what's the BSD game one? I think it's just called Adventure or something. I forget. The one with the grill. So you can think of it like that. You can think of it if you come from the Mac world, the old Mac world, you might have experienced the HyperCard thing, the HyperCard era, I guess, where you're this kid and you're just making these little clickable games, and they're a lot of fun. One of the games that I remember fondly a long time ago was, I think it's called Deja Vu, and you're this sort of hard-boiled detective, and you're going through these screens, and you're just clicking on things, and you click on items, and you click on doors to walk through them, and so on. And so it's a sort of a very visual way of telling basically a text-driven story. So if you are familiar at all with Wikitext, that's pretty much what Twine is. The programming of Twine, at its core and at its most basic, is Wikitext. If you know how to do Wikitext, then you can build a story. And if you don't know how to do Wikitext, you can learn it in maybe 5 minutes. It's really, really easy. So the most basic thing to do in Twine, I guess I'll go over here to the Twine application, which I have open, and I'll click the big green button on the right-hand side that says Story. And if you roll over it on your mouse, it says create a brand new story. Okay, well, that's pretty simple. So I'll just do demo, and I'll add that. And then it takes you to kind of a cool looking graphical interface. And there's one, let's call it a card, and it's called Untitled Passage. And it says double click this passage to edit it. So you double click it, and you're brought to a little text editor. So you could say you turn on a radio, and you hear Klaatu voice talking about Linux. Now, if we want this to go, we've just made a little, we've defined what this card does. Oh, it's still untitled, so let's give it a passage. It's called Untitled Passage, so we'll call it Entrance, because that's gonna be the opener for our story. In the future, we may not need to have such a linear picture of what's meant to be first or what's meant to be second. But there you go. So it's called Entrance, and it says you turn on a radio and you hear Klaatu's voice talking about Linux. So let's just surround the word Linux with two brackets. So bracket, bracket, and then Linux, bracket, bracket. Now I'll close that, and now you can see right away that in the graphical interface, I have two cards. One is called Entrance, and it has the text that I just described with bracket, bracket, Linux, bracket, bracket. Now the bracket, bracket means that there's a URL, or a link, really, a URI, I guess. And that created, when you typed that in, it created a second card, and the card is called Linux. Double click this passage to edit it. So we could say Linux is an open source open source operating system. I know that's not exactly true. It's technically a kernel. Isn't it funny how when you are first sort of starting with Linux, you hear that critique about, Linux isn't the operating system, it's the kernel. And you think that's really stupid because, like, okay, it might be technically the kernel, but like, everyone calls the operating system Linux, so why are we being pedantic like this? And then as you get more, 10 years later, you're still using Linux, the operating system, and it actually starts to matter because you're like, well, I don't really mean Linux, the kernel. I mean, the OS. There's like it sort of clicks. Something clicks, and that sort of pedantry actually matters, or it at least it resounds. If it doesn't matter, it at least sort of resonates with you. That's where I am right now. I say Linux, and I think I don't really mean Linux. I do actually mean GNU Linux, but I guess we're just gonna say Linux anyway. I mean, I guess what we're really saying is that Linux is both the operating system and the kernel. I guess that's actually what's being said. I mean, whether you like that or not, that's what it is. Whether we agree with it or not. I think it's hard to disagree with, to be honest, because it is basically that's what the public has decided. Okay, so Linux is an open source operating system for, I don't know, let's do bracket, bracket, computers, bracket, bracket. So now we'll have a new card label computers, and you sure do. So you can, and then of course you could say, okay, well, I don't want the user to just have to go to computers. I want them to also to be able to go to open source. So we'll do bracket, 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 run open source. So now in your graphical view, you see that you have two branches from this one. So you go from entrance to Linux card, where it's talking about what Linux is, and then the user can either click on open source or on computers, and they'll go to a different card depending on which one they click on. And at any point during this process, you can click the play button, and it launches a little internal, sort of a browser window, I guess. And you see that it's a black screen, white text. You turn on the radio and you hear Gladue's voice talking about Linux. Okay, click on that. Oh, here we are at the Linux one. Open source, that's a blank card. But there you go. So you kind of get a feel for how this is going to look once you deliver the game. And that's the quickest possible demo to Twine that I can possibly offer. Now, the cool thing about Twine is that it is actually pretty flexible. First of all, the cards themselves, they're just, you know, it's HTML and CSS with a JavaScript backend called Harlow, Harlowe, and that's just kind of bundled in there with it. There are alternative JavaScript backends for Twine that you can use in your game, and they add a couple of maybe better features, some more flexibility, really. So the one that I've played around with in the past is called SugarCube. And SugarCube, you have to download separately. Twine does ship with an earlier version of SugarCube, but you can always get the latest manually. Once you download it, you can unzip the archive and place it in some location. Doesn't really matter where you put it, because you're gonna tell Twine where to find it, and then Twine, when it's bundling up your application, which, by the way, it bundles Twine applications are cross-platform by nature. They're, again, HTML and JavaScript, so they're gonna run on everything, which is great, cross-platform. So what you'll do is you'll look in the SugarCube directory that you just downloaded, unpack it, whatever. Look in there, and there's a file called format.js. That's the actual library that you need. That contains all of the important bits. So format.js, you want to copy the location of that. You can just right click on that file and select copy, and now it's in your clipboard. And then go back into the Twine window, and at the lower on the lower left corner of the Twine window, you'll notice that there is a little house icon. So if you click on that, then it takes you sort of to your to the lobby, I guess, of Twine. It takes you to your big global project view, and you'll see that there's a little demo that we created. Okay, so then on the right hand side, there's a button, or a link rather, called formats. If you click on that, that brings up a new pop-up window, and there, as I said, you can see that it's listing the current formatting library as Harlow. In my version, it's 2.1.0. And then if you click on add a new format, you can add a new format library, which you've just copied to your clipboard. So paste that into the text field, click add, and now you have a new SugarCube version that's probably more recent than what Twine ships with. Although if you're fine with the version, if you can just use what Twine ships with, the SugarCube version that it ships with, it's fine. And I'll really quickly tell you how to modify a project to do that. So now you've got a format added, or you've selected a format, the SugarCube format. Now in your project, if you go back to your little lobby area, your little house area, then if you open up a project, so here's my demo project again, and then I click on the demo, the title of the project down at the bottom left. Click on that, you get a menu and a couple of different things to choose from there. One of which is change story format, and that lets you select from the formats that you've added to your environment which JavaScript library pretty much the Twine story uses. So by default, it generally gets set to Harlow, so you can choose SugarCube. Here's the SugarCube 2.21 that it ships with. And now if you click the play button to test your little story out, you see that you have a side panel on the left, and this permits users to restart the game, or probably more importantly, create save states for the game. So if your game is more than just a quick 2-minute walkthrough project, then they can actually create save games, and they can collapse the little window on the, or the panel on the side on the left, so it's not always visible to them, but it gives you that little bit of flexibility. Now, there's a bunch more stuff that Sugar Cube adds other than a side menu. It adds things like variables. You can set variables throughout the game so that if someone collects a certain item, for instance, then when they collect that item, a variable gets set to true. So now they have the Sword of Vanquishment or the Eyeglass of True Sight or whatever it is that they've collected. You set that variable and then add a story point where potentially they could use that item. I guess even a simpler example would be a key. They find a key. Do they pick it up? Yes, they do. Okay, so now when they go turn the corner and there's a door there that's locked, if they have the key, then among the choices that you provide them, among, you know, trying to break down the door or just turn around and go some other way, there could be this option based on whether they have the key or not to use the key on the door. Now, if they don't have the key, you wouldn't have to present that option to them. And the way that you would do that, again, is with the Sugar Cube library, and it offers you not only the set macro to set a variable value, but also an if else macro. Now, all that macros are listed on motoslave.net/sugarcube/2/docs. And there's a section in there called macros, and it goes through all the different ones. There's set, unset, remember, forget, run, scripts, if, for, switch, there are buttons and checkboxes and all kinds of things, really. There are a bunch of, and there are some audio ones in there to play sounds. So there's quite a lot of functionality with the Sugar Cube thing above and beyond what Twine by default. Twine by default pretty much offers you a wiki, a self-contained wiki, kind of like TiddlyWiki. If you've ever used or heard of TiddlyWiki, it's a self-contained wiki that you just download this empty TiddlyWiki project and then you start building it out, you know, using wiki syntax. And you've got like this self-contained little notebook, really, that or a website if you please, but I think it's originally intended, it's supposed to be sort of like a desktop wiki that you can just kind of keep on hand in this one file, so you don't have to manage a bunch of infrastructure. It's just this simple self-contained entity, and that's what Twine pretty much by default is. But then if you add Sugar Cube library to it and set that as your formatting option in your project, then you've got a lot of other cool options. So publishing a Twine project is you click on the name of your project. Once again, once you know you open your project, so you're in your little your project builder mode, and then you click the name of it of the project lower left corner and choose publish to file, and that exports your project as a single HTML file. Now, whether or not you're using items outside of that HTML file is up to you to know and to organize. So your project directory needs to have all of those assets available to that HTML file. So if you upload this, for instance, to the internet for people to play online, then you have to have all your assets associated with it in the correct path, you know, along with your upload. So in other words, if I had demo.html and then I knew that it was using assets from the image folder right next to the demo.html file, then I would upload both demo.html and img to the same, you know, that image folder to the same directory on my web server, and then people would be able to navigate to example.com/demo.html, and all of those assets would be found because it's in the same path, the path being .img/example.png, whatever. So that's Twine. It's a lot of fun, and I think what kind of got me thinking about this, aside from a frequent pastime being playing solo playable games over holidays when I had nothing better to do, is also something that Lost in Bronx has been talking about lately on his quirky little audio diary series. I don't know if you I don't know if you personally know who Lost in Bronx is, but if you do, then you may or may not know that he has this series of audio diaries that he posts. It's actually a fairly frequent post. I mean, he seems to be able to have the opportunity to record his thoughts about whatever he's thinking about pretty regularly. I mean, maybe 3 times a week. So it's pretty frequent sort of, I mean, it varies because it really is. It's just whenever he has a chance to be in his car, for whatever reason, he tends to record one of these audio diaries. And it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that, right? I mean, it's very much a mixed bag of content and quality. I mean, sometimes it's just him talking about what he made for dinner last night. And then other times it's these semi-philosophical observations or musings about the nature of art or human nature or how humans relate to art. And sometimes it's just him burying his soul about how he's concerned about this or that, about, you know, the quality of his writing or whatever. So it's really an interesting listen, actually, sort of in a morbid sense. You know, it's like, it's just listening to this person's diary, which seems very invasive, but I mean, he's putting it out there and he's aware that some people are listening to it, and it is quite fascinating, actually. So I listen to those fairly frequently, just kind of in the background as I'm doing other stuff. And on one of his recent shows, he talks about how it's never been easier to tell a story. And it's kind of, I mean, it's one of those obvious observations that people kind of make, and it's almost a cheap observation to make, you know, because it's so obvious. It's like, yeah, we know, computers, we all have a story to tell, we can tell it, whatever. But at the end of the day, I feel like a lot of times it's not really explored exactly what that means. You know, like, what does it really mean to, quote, tell a story? And why is it, quote, never been easier? And Lost in Brooks was talking about a video, all through which I was thinking, nope, he's overestimating the simplicity of video. And he said straight up, he said, quality notwithstanding, like, just forget the quality part and just say, okay, I want to tell a story with video. Like, why aren't you doing that? Like, it's super easy. And I kept thinking, no, it's way more complex than what he's saying. And I think what I was really reacting to was the acknowledgement that having a story to tell is one thing, but then structuring that story into a narrative is a different problem altogether. And I have a feeling that in many ways, when we all say, oh, it's never been easier to tell your story, what we're talking about are the nuts and bolts. Like, hey, you want to tell a video story? Well, now you have the tools to do that. You want to tell an audio story? Now you have the tools, whatever. You want to tell, you want to write? Well, you've got tools for that now. It's all digital. It could be all digital. You just put it on the internet, blah, blah, blah. But the problem, like the blocker for a lot of people, isn't necessarily the nuts and bolts. That stuff maybe isn't a problem. Maybe it's never been a problem. Maybe it has, but maybe it hasn't. The real blocker here that the digital age has not been able to affect, I think, at all, is that thing where you've got this idea, so now how do you get it into a narrative? How do you tell your story? I mean, you can tell the idea, right? You have a really simple idea. Oh, I have this idea of an elder god coming back to conquer the world, and he ends up being conquered by the world because the world is such a cruel and harsh place. Okay, easy. That's an idea. But now how do you tell that story? How do you relate the story as a narrative rather than just a, here's my idea? You know, like, that's not a story, that's an idea. So how do you get that from idea to story? And I imagine that Twine might actually be very useful for that, because Twine forces you to highlight the story beats. It forces you by way of saying, okay, you've got a card, or a passage, as they say. You have passages, and you can type. I mean, you can type, you know, as much text into one passage as you want, but you know that the expectation is that you're going to see a screen full, or a window full of text, and there are going to be choices at the end. So you need to fill this card up with some text, as much text as you think people will read, and then end it with these two choices that people can make. So you'll do that, and that's a story beat. And those buttons represent the story beats. So even if you made a Twine project without any choices, and you just, you know, sort of like, here's all the text, and here's the significant word that's going to get you to the next card, that's your story beat, right? The Elder God has, ... emerged, ... from the ocean. Okay, so emerged, that's your story beat. The Elder God has just come forth. Okay, so new beat. So what called him forth, or what is he doing now that he's emerged, or whatever. So, you know, you've got these sort of built-in demands on you as you try to convey your story that might in fact help you to structure that story. And it's probably worth talking at some point, not on this show by any means, but on Hacker Public Radio, about story structure and what that magical formula is that people, that humans tend to like. I mean, I tend not to like it myself, but it's kind of like there are a certain number, there's a certain amount of paint by numbers that you can do to end up with a story based around your idea to result in something that people will find pleasing to experience. I mean, it's obviously not a surefire thing, and there are also obviously exceptions to people who maybe detect that formula and try to reject it, such as myself. I tend to not really like the formula stuff. I mean, even with me, though, it works sometimes, right? I mean, just some things follow the formula, but they deviate just enough to sort of make it less obvious, and so it works. Or maybe it doesn't work for other people. You know, I have a feeling that when that happens, that's the acquired taste division of modern art. But I'm digressing, and certainly Lost in Bronx covers a lot of that in his Hacker Public Radio series about stories and story writing and narrative. So if you haven't listened to that, it's worth listening to. But that's it. That's really, Twine is the thing that I wanted to introduce to you. It is a lot of fun. It's a cool little method of writing click-through games that tell stories that are really good substitutes for pretty much the RPG experience, but on a computer. And it's one of those things where these solo games and stuff, they scratch that itch. They if you wanted to play an RPG in a simple kind of a simplified way, you know, you don't want to have to go get the proprietary Steam client and then pay 50 or 80 bucks for the big fancy RPG game, and you know, that's not your style, then and maybe the old archived PDF of that D&D adventure is a lot of fun, but maybe you want to tell it your own or whatever, then Twine is a really great avenue towards that, and it's worth checking out if you have any interest in that sort of thing at all. And even if you don't, it might be something good to have in your back pocket, because I always come across somebody who mentions, oh, I want to do this really simple game online, you know, and they don't need it to be super fancy with animations and sprites and a game controller. They just want some pictures and some text and some choices. Twine. Twine is great for that. So here's a couple to check out if you're still not sold on this idea. There's one at mookiechick.co.uk/DolorisandtheCave.php. It's worth checking out. There's another one at bittercarella.itch.io/Roberta-Williams-Eats-A-Sandwich. It's a really good one. And then there's an interesting one over at philome.la/miroaoc/dream-state-0/play. So I'll put links into those. And hey, you know what's the holidays? So you know what that means. You can drink as much coffee as you want. Let's talk about Linux distributions. This is one of those fallback topics, you know, it's one of those things where just you can always talk about Linux distributions on a Linux podcast, that's easy. But it's something that I don't tend to do anymore all that often. I mean, sometimes I'll talk about how I've tried this computer, this distribution or that distribution, like maybe a Magia or a BSD or something like that. But generally, I tend to shy away from it for a couple of different reasons. Number one, I do believe that as I've said before, I don't think distributions are the right way to go. I think that we as Linux users and developers are smarter than this. We should be able to say that there are, you know, that there's a certain minimal base install of the operating system, of the GNU Linux operating system. There is this collection of files that everyone's going to need. Now, on top of that, you may or may not add things like systemd or bsdinit or minit or openrc or systemd or what's the other one? Not openrc. There's a couple of different ones out there, and you might add one of those in there. You might add pulse. You might not. You know, all the little details. And I think that you could call those distributions, like at, you know, some really low level, but not the lowest level. There's middle ground where, yeah, we could say, okay, there's a couple of different distributions. There's the Fedora base or the RHEL base, whatever. Well, technically, really, a Fedora base. There's a Fedora base. There's probably the Debian base. There's maybe a hybrid base, you know, something that takes a little bit from each. There's the Slackware base. And maybe, I guess, there's like the sort of Linux from scratch base, you know, where truly it is a different distribution. But on top of all that, generally speaking, you know, I would go so far as to say 9 out of 10 distributions that we see out there are just remixes of one of those standard bases. So I don't think that you should have to download 700 megabytes or 1 gig just to experience a different set of default applications and maybe a different package manager, that sort of thing. I think that's a betrayal of common sense. I don't like to encourage that a whole lot. To be honest, I have a feeling that if we talk too much about distributions, it kind of highlights that we're doing this wrong, that what we should be doing with a couple of mod scripts or whatever you want to call them, you know, a couple of mods for your Linux base, and yet we're just rolling them into ISOs and putting a new brand name and logo on them and telling people to download these things. And I think it confuses a lot of things. It confuses the issue. It confuses how do I get into Linux. It becomes confusing. But that said, there are a lot of distributions out there, and it's kind of a fallback topic for a Linux distribution. And I do think that sometimes taking a look at what's out there is worthwhile. Because this is the argument for a distribution, right? There are times where you're sitting in front of a computer that will not boot. You know that you need it to boot. You need this thing up and running within the hour. And you need to know the best and fastest and easiest and no-brainerist way to do that. And it's happened to me, you know? And I think part of the problem is the second guessing, right? Because you think, all right, I know this one will work. This distribution, I'm sure it will work. It does really well with everything that you try to put it on. But I don't really run it. You know, that's the struggle. It's like, God, man, if I install that, then I'll have to support it. And I don't really want to have to support it because I don't know it that well. It'd be so much easier if I just could do this. Oh, but if I do this, there's going to be a bunch of setup. And then I'm going to have to configure all these things. And I don't really want to go through that right now. So there is this argument for distributions, I think, where sometimes having the several choices of a couple of different distributions, just kind of, it makes sense because you can pick the one that you have had great experience with on that set of computers that you know that you tend to have to maintain, and you can install it, and everything's peachy. So let's talk a little bit about some of the distributions out lately, because it's good. It's good to keep tabs on what is available. So I am ripping this topic right off of itsfoss.com. By the way, have I ever said I don't really love the abbreviation FOSS or FLOSS? I feel like it's once again, it kind of highlights the inefficiency of what the open source sort of crowd has let itself become embroiled in. FOSS, free and open source software. FLOSS, free and libre open source software. It feels embarrassing that we don't even have one term that we can use for this stuff. And so we have to come up with these obscure acronyms for the terms that we can't agree on. And it's embarrassing because it's just, what you can go to someone and say, hey, I use a lot of FOSS. What that is? And of course, it still has the same essential problem, which is that stupid English word free doesn't actually mean what we want it to mean, so it doesn't help clarify that by any means. It's just, it's a horrible, horrible idea. I don't know why people use it. But anyway, so itsfoss.com, itsfoss.com/lightweight-linux-beginners. So this is a list. It's a top 10 list. It's a listicle. It's the easiest kind of content to generate. And it's great because on holidays, this is the kind of content you want. It's kind of the easy stuff, right? So 10 on their list is Peppermint OS. Now, I have used Peppermint OS before. I have talked about, I think, Peppermint OS on this very show before. I think I have. And I got to admit, it's kind of a nice little OS. Apparently it's developed for sort of cloud-based experience, apparently. I'd never heard that, but that's what this article is saying. But it is supposed to be for, a lightweight netbook type thing. That I did know. It is specifically lightweight. And I feel like it does a pretty good little mix of being lightweight, but being, very familiar feeling and very easy to navigate the desktop and that sort of thing. And it's fast. It feels snappy when you install it. It feels good. I think it runs on 1 gig of RAM, supposedly, which I believe. I haven't really seen 1 gig in a while. 2 gigs, I think, is as low as I've seen recently. I mean, 2 gigs... Actually, most Linux runs okay on 2 gigs, to be honest with you. But it's still nice that you can go, that low and still feel like you're going to get a good experience. And apparently they have a custom, what they call ICE, I-C-E. And ICE it's an application to sort of grab a website and turn it into what looks and acts like a desktop application with all the conveniences of a desktop application. So in other words, if you right click on a certain kind of file that you want to open up in this specific application, except it's not an application, it's a website, then it creates detects that. It knows that this is that kind of application for that kind of file. So it's they call the system ICE. I don't exactly know why, but the thing that it is that it creates is essentially a site specific browser, which they abbreviate as an SSB. And you can base your ICE application, your fake application, on Chrome, Chromium, Firefox, or Vivaldi. So you can install it for whatever browser you prefer, and it becomes, for all intents and purposes, integrated into your desktop like an application, except that it's not. It's just going to open up a web browser to a specific site with a specific profile and so on. So it's kind of interesting. It's kind of an interesting idea. And it's Peppermint. It's a pretty small download too. It downloads pretty fast. You don't need any kind of special media for it. It's easy to install. I've used it in the past. I mean, not used it myself, but I've installed it onto a computer in the past for someone, and it worked out quite well. All right, number 9 on their list is Ubuntu, which, of course, is the LXDE version of Ubuntu. And it's been great. It's been fantastic. That's another easy bet, I mean, Peppermint, I think, itself is based on Ubuntu anyway. I could be wrong about that. Maybe it was at one point and now isn't. I'm not sure. But Ubuntu is, it does exactly what you would expect. And it's got all the nice features that Ubuntu has, which, of course, some people don't like because maybe it takes care of too much for them. But in terms of you need to get a computer up and running with Linux really soon, you're not sure what the capabilities are, Ubuntu is kind of a surefire bet. It's one of those things that it'll get you to where you want to be very quickly with minimal work, really. So that's a good one, Ubuntu. Now, my problem at this point with anything Ubuntu is that I'm not very familiar with some of the internal conventions of Ubuntu itself. And that's me, but I'm not saying it's a problem. I'm just saying it is it, It's a problem that I have, so if I'm setting up Ubuntu, it generally takes me a little bit longer to figure it out, because I have to look up, okay, well, how do I add a repository, or how do I enable, you know, this group of repositories that Ubuntu has off by default, but that I want on, and then I tend to get very sort of mixed up. Am I doing Ubuntu, or am I doing Debian? Does it actually matter? Is there crossover? It kind of becomes difficult to figure out quickly, so that oftentimes defeats the purpose of a quick install. But that's just because I'm not up on Ubuntu, really. It's not by no means the problem of Ubuntu. And I think one of the advantages of Ubuntu is that it has its own set of conventions. So if you ask a question on the internet, how do I do such and such on Ubuntu, then you tend, I think, last time I checked, you tend to get a pretty universal kind of Ubuntu-based answer. And so, yeah, the location or the name of the control panel or whatever might be a little bit different, but once you're there, then sure enough, the thing for the repository management or whatever is right where you expect it, or your package manager, your GUI package manager thing is exactly the same on this one as it is on that one. And I could be wrong. I haven't checked back lately. I really honestly don't know what Ubuntu's up to lately, but there is a certain amount of, I don't know, I guess that's what I've always said about Ubuntu, or at least internally I've said that, is that Ubuntu has a mind share, it has a big mind share, and so when you are looking for information on how to do something, it is generally fairly simple to find out how to do it, as long as you're specific about it being on Ubuntu. And that's allowing for the fact that probably their wiki and their documentation probably needs a little bit of maintenance. People need to clear out old answers and get rid of arguments about stupid details here and there. But generally speaking, I do feel like it's easy. Okay, 8 on this list is Linux Lite. Linux Lite is apparently just, again, Ubuntu LTS, but it is fully functional out of the box, according to the team, the Linux Lite team. It's got everything you need, so that in theory, when you install it and boot it up, it has everything that you would want, which would include very notably VLC and LibreOffice and GIMP, and I guess even like Dropbox and stuff like that. So it's got stuff that, yeah, again, I think there's an argument that most people looking for a computer would kind of be very pleased at these additions, and so it's nice to have it in a distro already included. I do believe that there's a place for that sort of thing, having, again, already complained that distributions are kind of the wrong way to do it. And I do. I stick by that. I still think that, technically speaking, we could have a system where, rather than having it already installed, there are some things on the desktop or somewhere that says, you know, install this, and you click on that, and then it launches a script, which should be a no-brainer for a bunch of savvy programmers and users like Linux people, and it downloads the latest Dropbox image and installs it on the computer, and then people are good to go. You know, they sign in, and now it's done. It's just as easy as that. I don't see how that would be any more trouble than setting up, you know, a new computer from any other vendor, really. But I digress. I've already said all of this. So the 7th thing on this list is LXLE, which is a respin of Ubuntu LTS, which is kind of funny because this is a list of 10 items, and already like 3 or 4 of them have just been remixes of Ubuntu. But anyway, the LXLE thing is it's supposed to be lightweight but very friendly to the eye, very easy to find stuff. Kind of funny because the screenshot of the system has like a task manager running in a terminal, which doesn't exactly say to me super friendly. I mean, at least that's not what you hear people talking about when they say super friendly, but anyway, it's supposed to be intuitive and lots of eye candy and stuff. So I've never tried LXLE, but if it's based on Ubuntu, again, I think you can probably anticipate that it's going to work pretty easily, pretty much out of the box, and pretty much on any computer that you throw at it, which is really, really nice. Again, when you're going to set up something for someone else, in my experience, the thing that I don't want to spend a lot of time on is the install process. Because almost invariably, I know that I'm going to have to spend time getting the computer set up to what I know that they want. You know, that I know this person, I know that they're going to need this, or maybe I don't know the person, but I anticipate that they'll be a normal, everyday computer user, so they're going to want this and that installed, and they're going to want some solution for this thing, and, you know, just make sure that it's all kind of, like, curated, really. So the curating process is the thing that I tend to spend time on when I'm setting it up for someone else, rather than, you know, ideally, I don't have to spend a whole lot of time on the actual install. Like, let's get that part out of the way. Let's just get this thing up and running online, and now let's curate. Six on their list is Crunchbang++. Now, Crunchbang++ is, of course, the continuation or fork or whatever of the long-gone Linux distribution called Crunchbang. And Crunchbang, I know a lot of people were super, like, into Crunchbang, and I never honestly understood why, because as far as I knew, it was just Debian with OpenBox. And I'm not saying that it wasn't a good thing. I guess I'm just surprised at how strongly it resonated with people. And I know that I've talked to the guy who ran Crunchbang, and he's a super nice guy. So I'm not by any means saying that it was, you know, it's weird that Crunchbang existed or anything like that. It was just weird how popular it was among everyone that I knew, because, again, to me, it just sounded like, okay, just install Debian and then install OpenBox. And as far as I know, that was it. Whatever the appeal, it did appeal to people. People were excited about it. People liked it. People used it. And I think a lot of people were very sort of surprised that it went away. So it's, I guess, no surprise that Crunchbang++ exists now. And it is. It's Debian with OpenDox. Would I use it? No, still no. I don't want to use Debian. I don't want to use OpenDox. And I don't want to use most of the applications that come installed by default on Crunchbang++. For instance, Terminator, Thunar, and what was the other one? Genie IDE. All of those I don't technically have a problem with. It's just that those aren't my first choices on a computer that I'm using. Would I install it for someone else? Yeah, probably in a heartbeat. I think probably someone who's trying to, you know, learn programming or something, they might really, really enjoy that sort of thing. I mean, if that's what they're expecting, if they want, you know, the elite hacker computer, this would be probably a nice nudge in that direction that they might really, really like that. And all those applications are great. Thunar is great. Genie is great. Terminator is great. They're just not what I install for myself. Okay, so fifth on this list is, I guess it's called Bodhi, or Bodhi, Bodhi Linux, which is something that I'm pretty sure, I want to say Lost in Bronx used Bodhi for a very long time, and I think that's more or less how I heard of it. It is a lightweight Linux running Enlightenment. Now, Enlightenment, I've tried fairly recently, and I gotta say, it always gets me like 80% of what I want, and then there's always like 20% of something that I can't get around for whatever reason, and I never end up staying on Enlightenment. It's always, I want to be on Enlightenment, like very frequently I think, oh man, I should run Enlightenment for a while, and I do for some amount of time, and then something happens, you know, whatever it is, and I just find it either too inconvenient to tolerate or just not exactly how I want it, and I end up straying again. That said, I do believe Enlightenment's quite beautiful, and it's pretty interesting that Bodhi Linux makes it it bases itself, you know, the desktop is important to these things, and so being the Enlightenment, or yeah, I guess I would say the Enlightenment distro, is a big deal, I think. So that's Bodhi Linux. And if you want to try Enlightenment, probably, you know, sort of at its best, then that would be the way to go, I think. That said, I don't know exactly how much customization Enlightenment really wants you to do. I get a feeling that Enlightenment kind of wants you to just use Enlightenment the way that Enlightenment is meant to be made, which is okay. It's not a bad thing. I just feel like it's not as customizable, certainly, as maybe Fluxbox or KDE. That's okay. But just that's the way it is, I think. Although there's an argument against that too, so don't get me wrong. Okay, so number four on this list is Antix, A-N-T-I-X, with a capital X. This is a lightweight Linux distribution based on Debian. It is systemd3. So if you do not like systemd, then this would be something to look out for. Antix uses the IceWM window manager, which I've certainly heard about. I think I've tried to use it once or twice, and I just don't have the patience to learn the customization options, and I always kind of move on. I guess my fascination with desktop stuff must have ended some years ago, because lately I can't get excited about customizing a desktop anymore. It's either the Fluxbox set of configurations that I've had since I think 2010 or so, or KDE, which the customizations I've had since, yeah, probably the same general time, actually, probably since 2010. They get updated as new releases are released, but it's basically the same set. There's just little tweaks here and there. But I'd certainly heard of Antix before this list, and I'm pretty sure I've tried it, and if not, then certainly I'd tried its predecessor. Yeah, I guess its predecessor. I'm not exactly sure on the lineage of it, but there's Mepis Linux. You've probably heard of Mepis. It's more or less ancient. I mean, it's been around for a long time. I don't remember, I honestly do not remember when it's not been around. And I mean that certainly as a compliment, because it's quite the accomplishment to keep something going for a very long time. So Mepis Linux, if I recall correctly, again, it was always kind of geared towards low end, but maybe that was just kind of a benefit of being Linux, because apparently Antix was a purpose-built version of Mepis for old computers with low processing power and RAM, and Antix and Mepis now kind of are, well, according to the Mepis website, it's a member of the official Mepis family. That is what Antix is. So I don't know exactly what that means, but that's how they define it. But it's quite nice. It's a good little distribution, both of them, Mepis and Antix, and systemd3. So if you really, really don't like systemd, then that would be a sincere, honest thing for you to possibly try, Mepis or Antix. And that's Debian-based. I think I said that already. So number three on this big list is Sparky Linux. I'd never heard of Sparky Linux, to be perfectly honest. But apparently there's a full and a base edition. So the full edition is the big, sort of bloated, you know, not really for necessarily for lightweight computer version. And then there's the base edition, which I guess is just the, pretty much just the OS, I think, is what it sounds like. And so it ends up being lightweight and pretty easy going on the system resources. Apparently, one of the things that you can install on Sparky is the Mate desktop, which I think, I mean, first of all, of course you can, but also I think it's kind of interesting, the Mate desktop. It really is quite lightweight, and I feel in a way that Mate is almost the new XFCE. I mean, I know a lot of people really like XFCE, but I feel like Mate is, it is, you know, computers have gotten good enough now that what we might consider an old computer certainly doesn't require, you know, some of the really bare-bone, like, Fluxbox-type solutions. So Mate very often can run on what we would call an old computer, and it would feel just fine. Whether or not, I mean, there are degrees of what an old computer is, so whether or not that fits your description or not, yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm just saying that Mate qualifies sometimes as a lightweight desktop environment, and it's interesting to see what can qualify as a lightweight environment. And I guess that's not even just for Mate. I mean, even looking at XFCE or looking at a carefully manicured IceWM, or certainly Enlightenment, they can offer a lot of surprisingly modern kind of full feeling experience of a desktop. It's pretty amazing. So number two on this list is Puppy Linux, and of course Puppy Linux is, as I recall, one of the preferred distributions of my friend Lost in Bronx, which is madness to me. But apparently, yeah, it's for real. Like, people use Puppy Linux. I've always liked Puppy Linux in theory, and I've installed it on some really ridiculous computers. But then I've just never, I guess what it boils down to is that I've never been in a situation where Puppy was the only option. And I feel like in order for me to use Puppy Linux, that would be, it would have to be the only option. In other words, the only computer available to me would have to run Puppy Linux, or would only run if it was running Puppy Linux. And for that reason, I kind of feel like Puppy Linux is really, really important. Like, in my mind, Puppy Linux is one of those just insanely important projects that we have to have, because, you know, failing everything else, Puppy Linux will run a computer. Now, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic because I feel like a lot of other things will too, but Puppy Linux is sort of, it's the one that's kind of always been there, and I anticipate it always being there, and I hope it is. But and when I say that it will run anything, I really do. I mean, I run it off of a CD, you know, on a computer with no hard drive, that sort of thing. And you might think, well, you can do that with a USB drive. Yeah, well, you can't believe some of the computers you come across, you know, like they just won't boot off of a USB stick for some stupid reason. There's no good reason, it just doesn't work. So CD, Puppy Linux, now you're running the computer. Save all your stuff to a thumb drive, you're done. Save it back to the CD drive if you want. There's an allowance for that. Or I've even had it on an SD card. Right, the computer was running off the SD card with Puppy Linux on it. I mean, it was amazing. It's just, it can boot seemingly off of anything. So I'm very, very fond of Puppy Linux in theory, but I've just never had to sit down and use it as my OS. And I think if I had to, I imagine I would be perfectly happy to do so, but because I can generally get something else running on the computer that I'm actually using, I've just never had to resort to Puppy Linux. Now, I think Austin Bronx said it because I think he had just recently, fairly recently, gotten a new computer, a new, like, used computer, and he was running Puppy Linux on it, and I think he was saying that some of the things that he was trying to install weren't really installing properly because of how Puppy Linux is kind of set up. And it, you know, there are quirks in Puppy Linux because of how flexible it is to get running on any computer. So I think that it treats its root partition a little bit differently than what we would normally think of. You know, something about it is a little bit different. So I think he had some problems with it and ended up switching to something else. But the requirements for Puppy Linux, according to Puppy Linux, is 333 megahertz CPU, 64 megabytes of RAM, recommended 256. And they're not kidding. It will do that. It will run on that machine and it will be fine. Now, on the first on their list, their lightweight Linux list on this itsfoss.com website, they list TinyCore. And TinyCore is another one of those things that I'm pretty convinced is super, super important. Whether or not it really should be listed here as a lightweight Linux, I feel a little bit ambivalent about that or conflicted about that rather, because on one hand, yeah, I get it, technically, yes, totally, but also not really. I mean, I don't see people running TinyCore Linux as their desktop. Now, I did meet someone in real life who said that they do run TinyCore and they actually use it as a distribution. Now, my problem with that, when I first tried it, and I think it was in a GNU World Order episode that I tried it and talked about it, my problem was that it's just really difficult to manage, like in terms of getting everything to be persistent and to load all of your little TinyCore modules in at boot. It starts to get, there's some weirdness that you have to kind of learn, and I never really sat down and learned how to make that happen. And again, I guess in a way, I probably am not going to learn it unless my only option is TinyCore Linux. Just because right now I'm doing other things. I'm not just trying to get computers up and running. In a different life situation, I might have the occasion to try to resurrect computers and see what I can do to get them back up and running. And that's a fun thing to do. And I would love to sit down with TinyCore and really get to know it. Now, there are a couple of different versions of TinyCore. There's TinyCore, which is just literally the core sort of modules or whatever. I'm sorry, there's Core, and that's just the modules. It's just, in fact, I think it may only be the kernel or something. And then there's TinyCore, which is the kernel and a little bit of user land. And then there's Core Plus, which is everything else plus an interface for downloading and installing, for lack of a better term, various applications. And they're specific. The way that they do it is very, it's kind of like like Slack's used to do it, or how Porteous does it. You got these little modules that kind of attach themselves to the rest of the system so that they seamlessly integrate with your OS, but they're not really traditionally installed the way that you'd think they would. So yeah, it is something that you kind of have to learn. Now, missing off of this list, amazingly, is the one that I really tend to use in real life, which is, of course, Slackware. It's quite funny that it's not on this list, but I guess it's partly because Slackware doesn't tend to advertise itself as a quote-unquote lightweight distribution. And I guess by some arguments that it's not a lightweight distribution, it comes with a lot of stuff. It's a 4 GB DBD, and it assumes that you're going to install the whole thing for a total of almost 10 gigs of data on your drive. That said, it can be a very lightweight distribution, so it's kind of funny to leave off Slackware, or at least, what is it, Salix or Zenwalk, one of those, because they're absolutely lightweight Linux. They're fantastic for older computers, and they're typically the ones that I default to. I think I've talked about on the show possibly how a nice little, no, it was actually a blog post that I did that I probably need to get online somewhere, but it's a kind of a cheater's way to get from Zenwalk or Salix to Slackware, so that you're installing these things off of their CD-ROMs or whatever, or their USB boot drives, as a workaround for the fact that Slackware has not had really a way to install from anything but its big install DVD. It's not entirely true, but yeah, sometimes it's a little bit easier with the Salix or the Zenwalk than it is for straight Slackware. But the minimum requirements for Slackware are dismal. I mean, they're like 64 megabytes of RAM, and I probably, again, probably something like 333 megahertz CPU, something around that benchmark. And it works splendidly. It works really, really nicely, and it's a pleasure to use. It is as heavy or as light as you want it to be. It's all really up to you. And I guess that's part of the problem, for a lot of people. They want the quick solution, myself included sometimes. I mean, sometimes you just don't want to deal with all the trimming and the trouble of installing. You just want the thing to be installed so that you can then curate the user environment. That's fine. But yeah, it was a weird omission, I think, of the article to leave off Slackware. That said, there are a lot of distros out there, so it's hard to kind of even come up with a list of 10 because there are so many out there. Where do you even start looking? Or maybe where do you stop looking? And I guess there's an argument too that one of those could have probably been, maybe should have been NetBSD. I don't want to bang on too much about NetBSD. I know I've talked about it a little bit on the show, and I feel like in real life I've been talking about it a lot. And like, it does feel a little bit like I finally found NetBSD. How exciting is that? But really, like, functionally, if you're looking at old computing gear and you're trying to get something installed onto it, I think your first two stops ought to be Debian and NetBSD. And that may sound a little bit funny for me because I don't love Debian. I don't love running Debian, rather. I love Debian. I just don't love using it myself. But I mean, their architecture support is second to none, and then NetBSD is basically the same. It's second to none. They've got installers or a way to install on practically anything you can think of, and that's significant. It's a little bit of a niche, maybe. I mean, probably when people say I need a lightweight distro for this old computer, they don't really mean I desperately need some way to hack a different OS onto this device, and sometimes that's what's involved with NetBSD, or downloading some of the more obscure installers from Debian, maybe. So anyway, that's probably everything. That has been the Christmas special, having nothing to do with Christmas or holidays or anything, but hopefully it has kept you company if you needed company today, and if not, hey, it's a bonus episode. It was fun. So thanks for listening, and I will talk to you next time, which will not be a bonus episode. Counting against the total for the year, so get ready for last. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is thatklaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me, thatklaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf.org. member.fsf as in freesoftwarefoundation.org. And of course you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Everyone.